From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. As an international conference on arboriculture takes place in Milwaukee, we talk with a city and state arborist about the health of Wisconsin's urban forests. Then, an exhibit at the Racine Art Museum explores the career of American jeweler and metalsmith Robert Ebendorf. It includes some European influences that changed the definition of valuable.
My design concepts are where the value is, not in how big the diamond is. And Bob was one of the early American artists who looked at that discourse and took it much further.
And the artist himself elaborates.
Instead of maybe using diamonds and gold and pearls all the time, I might be using a piece of metal off the street, a broken car fender. These objects become my precious material.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for being with us. Today is the middle day of the International Society of Arboriculture's annual three-day conference. Arborists from around the world are in Milwaukee to discuss best practices and to share information about how to protect and nurture our urban canopy. And as you might guess, it takes some work to keep it healthy. Local arborists tackle everything from invasive species like the emerald ash borer to everyday stressors like road salt and drought. Ian Brown is an Urban Forestry Technical Services Manager and ISA Certified Arborist Municipal Specialist for the City of Milwaukee. And Eric Peterson is also a trained Urban Forestry Specialist and is the President of the Wisconsin Arborist Association. They join me in the studio now. Gentlemen, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for stopping in this morning.
Oh, thank you, Bonnie. We appreciate being here.
Thank you very much.
When most of us think of forests, we tend to think of them as opposite of urban. Yet, Ian, you're a specialist in something called urban forestry for the city. So let's start there. Can you tell me what urban forestry is and why it's important?
Both Eric and I went to school for urban forestry. This is a profession that you go to school, either 2 or 4 year degree to get trained in. And it is really, I think of it as trees and people together. So a lot of times people think, oh, you know, I have to drive to the Northwoods or go someplace to be among the forest and among the trees. But many of us already have trees in our backyard. In the city of Milwaukee, we have street trees in our front yard that the city actually owns and maintains. So the urban forest is trees among populations of people, generally speaking.
Okay, so as opposed to forests, I think of forests as trees, but also other plants and things too. But it's much more specific here. It's trees. You're not talking about bushes and other kinds of plants.
I think those get incorporated too. What we've been working with as a profession is helping to get greater appreciation for trees. So historically, people see trees and they're like, oh, that's nice. And they provide shade. They're pretty. And that's about it. But when it comes to, you know, especially municipal budgets or, you know, hiring a private professional tree care company to do work, you really need to see the value that's coming back to be able to appreciate what's going on. So we've started really pushing for a new term. It's green infrastructure is what these trees and other green space have. Think of many street trees. You know, they're overhanging impervious surface. Milwaukee has a stormwater issue. So when we get storm events, those trees help to intercept some of that stormwater. There's a dollar value associated with that. Trees in the front yard help to beautify your property so you can sell your house either quicker or for more money. There's a dollar value associated with that. So what we're trying to do is help the public at large understand and appreciate that there is a very valuable resource that's growing in their front yard or around their property. And it's a resource worth investing in.
Well, it's also the lungs of the city too, right? I mean, trees and all plants give us oxygen.
For sure.
So, Eric, from your perspective, you're working with the whole state, right? It's not just Milwaukee, unlike Ian.
That is correct. Right. Yep. As part of the Wisconsin Arborist Association, we're actually a chapter of the International Society of Arboriculture. So the Wisconsin Arborist Association represents urban foresters, private commercial arborists all across the state. So we see challenges in the rural settings as well as in the city settings. And it's pretty neat to see the commonality of the same issues throughout the whole state that the city of Milwaukee is facing, as well as Green Bay or La Crosse or you name the city in Wisconsin.
So what are some of the threats to the health of the urban forest, wherever it happens to be?
Well, I think one that's front and center right now is emerald ash borer. That's what's definitely carrying the torch as far as getting us in front of people. Eric and I are both younger, newer to the profession. I really do see EAB as our generation's Dutch elms disease. So that's something that, you know, definitely swept through Milwaukee and the Midwest, devastating urban canopies. And, you know, we here in Milwaukee have actually started to do some preliminary research to quantify the amount of canopy loss that we had. And what we're seeing just anecdotally on the front end is we still have not recovered in the Milwaukee area from the elm canopy that used to be there pre-DED to right now. And now we're looking and staring emerald ash borer in the face. And this has another potential to really impact our urban forest. So, you know, we're trying to get up there front and center again to say, you know, your trees are there. Trees are different than a lot of other resources. You can't just go and buy, you know, a 40-year-old tree with mature canopy. You have to plant it and wait 40 years for it to grow. So in a lot of situations, especially with our ash trees here in Milwaukee, they're pretty large mature trees that we're seeing a lot of benefits from right now. The people that live in front of those houses, the people that live in our community right now, unless they're quite young, will very likely never see another tree in its same location of that same size within their lifetime. So, you know, these trees, to really see, you know, the majority of the return on your investment, they need to be in the landscape for, you know, 40, 60, 80 years. And there really isn't a reason why they shouldn't be able to be there. But urban areas are tough on trees, same as they can be tough on people. You know, you have a lot of kind of drought stress, you know, lack of moisture, high salt content because we salt our streets, urban soil compaction, urban heat island effect. Any of those things can make it very difficult for a tree to live, thrive, survive in an urban area. And that's why there are professionals out there to help make sure that those trees are put in a position to succeed.
So what's happening that's a positive in the urban forests in Wisconsin? What are some of the things you can point to that, you know, tally up on the good side of things?
With the Wisconsin Arborist Association and with emerald ash borer, seeing the devastation it's caused in Michigan and Indiana and Illinois, coming now to Wisconsin and becoming our major issue that we're having from a single pest problem, the community and the network and the resources that everyone's putting together to try to handle it the most appropriately, to contain it as best as we can, has been a team effort and has been exciting to watch unfold. And really the sharing of information will allow this industry to grow in the future faster, more cohesive, and really looking at not just the community of Milwaukee, but the community of Milwaukee and Wauwatosa and Franklin and how everything fits together on a broader scale. That's what's exciting from the state perspective.
I'll expand even a little bit further there. Since we're currently hosting the International Society of Arboriculture annual conference, we'll have anywhere from 2,000 to 2,500 individuals from around the world that are descending on Milwaukee to share their professional experience and expertise during the conference that's currently being hosted here. That's a really cool opportunity for Milwaukee. It speaks volumes about Wisconsin forestry, Milwaukee forestry, and the support that we have from ISA. As far as partnerships go, too, you know, I feel very confident where Milwaukee is positioned as we're kind of battling emerald ash borer. You know, it's come in our area. It is present throughout southeast Wisconsin now. Whether it's been confirmed or not, I think there's general consensus among professionals that it's basically here. It's just a matter of whether you find it. We were very fortunate that we've been able to build off of the experiences of others that found it before us, looking to Detroit, Toledo, Chicago, other places that have had to deal with this wall of wood that's caused by the devastation in EAB's wake if you do nothing or if you find it, you know, too late. There's a lot of research that's going on at the university level to identify management strategies, effective treatments, alternative strategies to just removal and replacement. And so a lot of that's been funded through the ISA Tree Fund, partnerships between universities, partnerships between universities in the state, and even private tree care has got involved too because they have their own research arm with some of these larger companies. So we're really kind of standing on the backs of those that have come before us to make sure that Wisconsin doesn't see the same level of devastation that we would potentially have had we not been able to learn from the past 6, 7, 10 years of EAB experience.
So if there's anything positive out of the emerald ash borer, it's the fact that it's brought all of you together and all of these resources are coming to play in saving our forests.
Oh, absolutely. And I think looking forward, yes, we're battling EAB right now, but this is a global economy and we're going to have more global pests that are either imported or exported throughout the world. And, you know, having the International Society of Arboriculture there to help facilitate that informational transfer really positions us well as a profession to help move urban trees, urban tree appreciation, and arboriculture as a whole forward within the world. Our urban areas are growing. We're going to want green space. We're going to need green space, to be quite frank with you. And that's the role of the professional. We're not hacks out there with chainsaws. I mean, we're trained in what we do. There are international certifications that individuals can pursue and have advertised for and with. And so that's something that we as an organization also help to try and move forward to, is helping the public appreciate that, you know, when you go out and you hire a certified arborist or a accredited tree care company, yes, you probably will pay a little bit more, but you get what you pay for, and they're going to do a professional job. They're going to clean up well. They're going to be insured. They're going to carry the torch for our profession how we would want, versus come in, do a lowball job, get in, get out, and however things work out, they work out.
Are there things that you're both particularly looking forward to taking advantage of during this conference time? Because we've got 3 days here. We're right in the middle of it right now. People you want to talk to or things you want to learn?
I think the neatest thing is that it is an international conference. So we can talk to people from New Zealand. We can talk to people from Poland. We can talk to people from England, really all over the world. There's 36 countries represented. And even though each country is maybe at a different stage in the level and the development of the industry, they're all facing similar issues, whether it's budget constraints or how to deal with a tree that's leaning over a street, whatever it might be. It's really neat to hear their story. And it helps us realize we're together with this. We're not alone in Wisconsin or in Milwaukee, that it's really issues that we all face. And talking to someone from overseas is pretty neat when they're talking the same language of tree language.
The tree language, I love it. And for you, Ian?
I think just trying to be immersed and experiencing as much as I can. You know, there's a whole range of educational sessions. There are social events in the evening to, you know, try and just build that camaraderie between individuals in the same industry. This last weekend, we had the tree climbing competition, which is actually a really unique event where we had the best tree climbers in the world that were here showcasing their skills and crowning a world champion here in Milwaukee. So, you know, I think that's really interesting. It's unique, and it really helps to draw focus to Milwaukee's place in urban forestry, which I think is very well positioned going forward.
If there was one thing that you could tell our listeners that they could do to help urban forestry, help Milwaukee, help if they happen to be outside of Milwaukee, what would be the thing that they could do to help trees and help our urban forests?
I think in general, just expanding the appreciation knowledge for urban trees. A lot of times there's something that's kind of there and we almost look past them. But when I sit down and talk with, you know, even students about what the tree is, the things that it gives back, the benefits that it provides, like, wow, you know, that's actually quite a bit. And all we have to do is let it grow. You know, there's been a lot of economic research associated with where the dollars go associated with tree management and the benefits that we receive. In the Midwest, it's about a 3-to-1 benefit to cost ratio. So that's a pretty good investment, you know, including all the expense of planting, pruning, even up to removal. The benefits that we're getting, the stormwater benefits, the carbon sequestration, the air pollution mitigation, you know, all the stuff that we were talking about before, those all have dollar values associated with them, and it's a 3-to-1 benefit-to-cost ratio. In general, urban trees, one of their primary stressors is just lack of water. And so, you know, we've been in a drought condition the last couple of years. This year's certainly been better. It hasn't been as hot this summer. But, you know, thinking if we don't get water or don't get a legitimate amount of rain, putting just a couple 5-gallon buckets of water around the base of your tree, slow trickle, twice a week, it's going to be pennies for you to do that. And it's going to really, really help the life of that tree.
And, you know, I was thinking, yes, they have this cost of benefit. That's great. You know, but they're also just beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, we studied urban forestry in school, but it wasn't until I got out of school and I got into the first office that I was up on the 7th floor of the Mayfair Bank Tower. I looked out towards downtown. All you see are the tree canopies. And it didn't take until that point that I realized that's the urban forest. It's a very pretty sight.
Well, I want to thank both of you for stopping by this morning. Enjoy the rest of the conference, and thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Bonnie.
Ian Brown is an Urban Forestry Technical Services Manager and ISA Certified Arborist and Municipal Specialist for the City of Milwaukee. Eric Peterson is also a trained Urban Forestry Specialist, and he's the President of the Wisconsin Arborist Association. The International Society of Arboriculture's annual conference is going on in Milwaukee as we speak, and it will wrap up tomorrow. There's more information about urban forests from WUWM.com/lakeeffect. Stay tuned. Coming up next, we'll take a road trip to the Racine Art Museum to learn about their current exhibit that features the found object jewelry of Robert Ebendorf. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The Racine Art Museum specializes in contemporary crafts. It showcases things like glasswork, ceramics, and jewelry of all kinds. One of the prominent artists represented in their permanent collection is American jeweler and metalsmith Robert Ebendorf. Ebendorf is originally from Kansas, and since the 1960s, he's been on the forefront of contemporary work in objects of adornment. He's also a pioneer in using found objects in his work. Bits and pieces of what others might consider trash become precious in his reuse of them in his work. The museum recently opened a retrospective of Ebendorf's work, and I traveled to Racine to see it and to speak with Executive Director Bruce Pepich. Bruce, welcome back to Lake Effect. It is a pleasure to be here.
We love having you with us, Bonnie. Thanks.
So tell me a little bit about the retrospective that you have going on. Why is he important in American craft, and why is he so important to the Racine Art Museum?
Well, what's interesting about Bob and his work is that Bob was trained as a classic mid-20th century metalsmith. And there are pieces in the exhibit that go back to early work in his career from the 60s and late 60s and early 70s when he was creating hollowware, hand-forged and hand-formed out of sterling silver, as everyone was doing at that time. But fairly soon after he was done with his graduate school work and a bit of travel abroad, he began to dabble in using unusual materials together with precious materials, maybe a piece of found resin or a piece of bone that would be incorporated with sterling silver and a pearl in a piece of adornment. And that just sort of set him off on a course of discussing what was the nature of adornment, what put value into the jewelry. And there were a number of contemporary European jewelers at the time who were looking at this and saying, hey, I really think that my design concepts and the things I want to say in the jewelry are where the value is, not in how big the diamond is. And Bob was one of the early American artists who looked at that discourse and took it much further, and also began to inject narrative elements in his piece because of the connotations that were existent in the materials he was recycling. So if he used a piece of a printed metal can or some plastic, it would come maybe with writing on it or some kind of a picture on it from the consumer world that it was designed to support. And it would change kind of in his studio. It would bring some of that early connotation with it, but it would be reinterpreted in a new kind of object.
Was he the first person who was really trying to put narrative into jewelry making, or was he somebody who was taking it and moving it further?
It was sort of like, you know, the match to the oiled rag school, you know, in that a lot of people became very, very fascinated with this fairly early on, and there was a lot of communication in the field, and a lot of graduate students and also professors began to show this kind of work and talk back and forth, so there was a big dialogue going on in the field, and American jewelry, more so than European jewelry, has a lot of narration in it, and there's a lot of storytelling that goes in it, and I think that kind of links up to, again, the fact that you go to a party and you have this old Victorian brooch on or a cameo, and someone comments on it, and you start telling them the story about what the jewelry means to you because of how it came down to you, whereas what these contemporary art jewelers are making in their studios is something that you wear that has their story in it. You then become part of the storytelling because you buy their work, you wear it, and then you start telling their story. So it's almost like a participatory collaboration that takes place. And so I think it's a very American portion of the craft field to have this kind of narration going on. And Bob, of course, taught at the university level through part of his career off and on, and has been prized as being one of the country's most giving instructors from the standpoint of really sharing not only his knowledge, but putting his students in connection with university, other university opportunities, commercial galleries, museum shows. He makes gifts of, going back to our relationship here, which goes back to 1991, one of his brooches came to the museum from a local collector as part of a gift. And he called us about 3 weeks after finding out about this, and he said, hey, I've got a sheet of sketches with drawings, and that brooch is one of the sketches on there. Would you like it for the collection? And we said, of course. And so then this dialogue started going back and forth with us, and he's been giving us his work and works by other artists that he owns to build our collection and our documentation of what was going on in the field. And I think that's the kind of person he is. It's not about, my career is not about advancing my work at the expense of everybody else's. It's, I want to raise the water that raises my boat, but also that raising of water will raise a lot of other boats along with it, and I welcome that. And I think that's why here he is at the age of 75. He's still working full-time, still in a university post where he's making connections for young artists like crazy and making work that when you look at it, you'd swear it was being done by someone in their 30s.
Why is he so important to your collection here and to the Racine Art Museum? How does he fit in to what you're trying to do here?
Well, one of the things that we're doing with our collection is we're creating the largest contemporary craft collection in the country to be found in any art museum. And we do have a substantive and substantial contemporary jewelry collection. And about half of that is work in precious material that we collect because it's handmade and also created and designed by the artists that make it. The other half of the collection are pieces of wearable adornment that are made out of all sorts of different recycled common materials. Bob uses everything from plastic trash he finds to, you know, an animal jaw that he'll inset pearls into the dried bone area, and he'll make a neck piece out of that. This is a new way of thinking about personal adornment and how unconventionally beautiful something that you wear can be and still be considered something that you would want to wear on your body, and how the person who owns and wears the jewelry engages with the artist by presenting the work again.
And we're standing right in front of the necklace that is actually on the catalog that you created for this exhibit. And among the things that I see are bits of plastic ware. I see a couple of Glenfiddich, I don't know what they are,
it's all tags, things like
tags,
plastic silverware and caps for ballpoint pens and those orange plastic things that you get that are wrapped around the ends of bags
bread.
Of bread.
Yep.
And then the lovely things are the plant stakes, the plastic plant stakes that you find in the plants when you buy them at the Garden Mart, and they have a picture of the blooming flower with its, you know, it needs full sun and this much water. Caps for milk jugs, and this is a big collar, and all of these things have been cleaned very lovingly and have had holes punched in them, and they're strung on these sort of base metal rings that you use when you valet a car, those little rings that they slide the key on. And so he's collected all of those and then strung all of this plastic, I will say trash, for the lack of any other word. And this piece is called the Off the Street from the Beach neck piece, and it's exactly what it is, what it purports to be.
Now, to the best of your knowledge, do you know if anyone's actually ever worn this?
Not that I know of. It was owned by someone for a while and then came fairly quickly to us. And again, some of these pieces that we have are worn by people and kept for a long period of time, and others of them are sometimes a little bit more theoretical, but that's again where the museum aspect of this comes in, because we're trying to give people ideas of what's possible, and sometimes they aren't necessarily practical.
And that's the one thing that this exhibition does, is it shows him in all of his glory. It's a retrospective, correct?
Mm-hmm. The core of the show is a group of a little bit over 40 objects that are from our collection. He's one of the artists we're collecting in depth. And then we have borrowed work from Bob's own historic collection of his work that he has maintained. And then also there are two gentlemen in the southeast portion of the country, and they're Porter Price, and that's the name of the collection. And the Porter Price collection has loaned objects to us, and we borrowed from them because they have been collecting like we do. They're collecting throughout his career from beginning all the way through to his later work, and they have promised some gifts to us for our collection from their collection of his work.
What is the earliest piece that you have here in this collection, in this retrospective right now, and then what's the latest piece?
The earliest pieces are works from the late 1960s. Those are primarily Holloware, and the latest things I think are from this year or last year. They're very, very recent.
Can you show me something that is from this year or last?
Sure, let's go take a look.
Okay. Okay, this is in the front of the gallery here, and this is just last year.
Mm-hmm. These are all from 2013, and they're a series that Bob created, and he calls it Keep It in the Can, and so they're all the Keep It in the Can brooch. And again, along the lines of what he did with the neck piece that we owned, Bob would pick up crushed aluminum beverage cans that he would find on the street, and they have to be flattened so that they can have a pin hasp attached to the back side of them. And he's really treating these like a bezel that you would set a stone within, or a prong that you would set a stone within. And what he's putting inside them are pieces of found costume jewelry. In other words, people give him things from their grandmother's jewelry drawer that they don't think have any, you know, mercantile value or monetary value. And so there'll be things that you can recognize as coming from brooches or hair pieces or neck pieces. And he's cut those elements out and then fitted them inside what's usually the top or the bottom of the can that stands up from the crushed element because it's reinforced, you know, at those edges. And so you have this sort of a stage set of the crushed can that in some cases it's almost like a shell revealing a pearl inside the shell as it's opened up. Or in one here he has a cutout of a young man on top of a horse, like a jockey, and it's from some kind of a printed tin food can of some kind that he's cut out, and it looks like it's sort of walking through the landscape.
I was thinking it was a toy, like a child's mm-hmm. toy, a printed mm-hmm. tin toy.
And it could be very much from that. You know, it's hard to figure out where the sources are because he collects so many different things and finds so much from so many places.
The other thing I really like about these is that in the piece that's where the inserted piece, the brooch or the little spiral that's up mm-hmm. there, is that he's also got something behind it that's not mm-hmm. originally part of the can.
Right. He's inserted another piece of printed, you know, metal to kind of act as a backdrop behind it, so that you're constantly looking at these layers, and the can is crushed into usually very interesting color and pattern that you might not have come up with if you did the crushing yourself. These are how he's finding them. And, you know, there's a tradition in 20th century art and of the found object, an artist finding something poetic or inspirational in a piece that they didn't make but that they take as they found it, and then they're incorporating it in with other elements that they make by hand. As, for example, this brooch in the case that we're looking at with the metal spiral, he's made the metal spiral out of an oxidized sterling or some kind of metal, and then he's stuck it inside the raised portion of the can, but he's put this image of a bird sort of
and
pecking away
mm-hmm,
from like a cherry, you know, juice or a cherry jam container of some kind. And again, you know, people send him things from abroad, or he picks things up when he travels. I sent him a whole box of metal tea containers I've been saving for him. We have a brooch here that was made out of a metal candy container with an image of Santa Claus and a sled that he inset pearls in to look like the stars in the printed tin. I mean, you can see how the one thing that is given to him that he didn't make then leads him off on this mental journey. And I find that the fascinating part of his work.
And he's somebody who's very glad that we have not stopped littering.
Yes. I would say he's always a very, very positive person, so he would find that as a plus.
Well, Bruce, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for taking time to show me a few things.
Thank you.
Bruce Pepage is the executive director and the curator of collections at the Racine Art Museum. The Life and Times of Robert W. Ebendorf, Jeweler and Metalsmith retrospective exhibit is on view at the museum through January. There's also a catalog available entitled Robert W. Ebendorf, The Work in Depth. We'll take a short break and then we'll speak with artist Robert Ebendorf himself. Stay tuned. You're listening to Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We'll be right back. We're back with Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Before the break, we spoke with Bruce Pepich, the executive director of the Racine Art Museum, about the Robert Ebendorf retrospective that's currently on view there. Pepich gave us an overview of why Ebendorf is so important in the contemporary jewelry world and to the Racine Art Museum. Now we'll talk with the artist himself. Ebendorf joins me by phone now from his office in East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. Bob, welcome to Lake Effect, and thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, it's a joy to receive the opportunity because it's always nice to sit down with mindful people and to discuss what I find exciting in my life and hopefully can touch a nerve with you all as well.
What I find exciting about the things that you've done in your life is that you have managed to incorporate so many different influences in your jewelry making, in your making. It's not just jewelry, but it started out there. And what was it about adornment? What was it about jewelry that first captured your imagination?
Well, I think that in high school, I took that first what we call the arts and crafts class, and at that time, we could do ceramics or jewelry or drawing, and I found that my interest went more towards jewelry. It could have been scale, and it could have been, I think, that I find still very, very important and exciting in my work is problem solving. How do I put an idea, you know, drawing on a piece of paper or an idea in my mind, how do I bring that idea or those marks on paper into form? So I think that there was an interest in making something, hands-on, solving a problem with materials.
Well, and your grandparents were tailors, is that
yeah.
correct? Yeah. So
yeah.
You came from a family that made things with their hands.
You know, and that light bulb did not go on in my life until I had to do a lot of public speaking, and I wanted to go back to my family in Kansas, and my grandmother was Swiss, my grandfather was German. And then I started speaking and remembering going to the tailor shop with my father as a very young boy and being put up on the table where all the cutting and the pattern, and bingo, the light went on. I said, oh, my goodness, I do come from a family of makers. So I really do feel that it was in my DNA, but I just got off the track and got into the hard stuff and the stuff of with metal. But it is a celebration that I speak oftentimes with great fondness.
Well, also, and there's a quote that is in the book that the Racine Art Museum has put out about this exhibition, and it struck me, and I wrote it down, which was, assembling is a primal activity for you. It's something that you said to someone in some interview, and I love that idea of that problem solving, but the touching of the objects and the physical assemblage as being something that is absolutely fundamental to who you are.
And then, you know, on that same spin, often when I walk home from school or if I'm out on an outing, I'm always gathering. I have a fanny pack and I'm always bending over picking up this or that. I mean, a piece of wire, a broken bottle cap, a headlight that's been broken, or maybe even in the dumpster, you know, kind of, oh my goodness, let's see what's in there. And I also think that the sense of gathering, the hunt, the excitement of the hunt, but it's also, I think, it touches my feminine side of myself in the sense I gather, bringing home and nurturing it, putting together, washing it, laying it out, looking, examining it, and then taking it into the assemblage or into the construction. So I think that, you know, there is a very interesting primal sense that there that, you know, as I got more mature in age, I was able to perhaps look more intelligently at that process and making order out of chaos. Because many things when I bring them home, I lay them down and it is just a chaotic gathering of objects and then, you know, then putting some kind of order to them. But I come from, and historically, I come from a family of makers, not only the tailors, but also the lineage of the goldsmith and the silversmith. I mean, the tools that I use today and some of the techniques that I embrace and make love with are tools and techniques that were handed down from the early days. So I do have a strong sense of reverence to the family, to where I, the things that I do.
Well, it sounds like both in terms of your techniques and the tools, but also the objects that you collect and as you say, lovingly care for and then figure out what you're going to do with them. It's like you're curating all of these aspects of your life that then somehow come together into these wonderful pieces.
I love your word curating. I've never thought about it in that context, but in a way it is. It is a sense where I am being very critical about how I edit out and how what I bring in. I oftentimes think that my work is very much about basic celebration of design and color. And instead of maybe using diamonds and golds and pearls all the time and precious metals, I might be using a piece of metal off the street and a broken car fender piece. But these objects become my gold, become my precious material, and I treat them with that kind of respect.
When you're collecting and when you're out walking or thinking about the next project that you're going to work on, do you have objects in mind that you're looking for, or do you pretty much collect what catches your eye and then figure out from there what you're going to do with them?
Great question. I find that when I was doing very formal things for the church or for the temple or for the president of an organization, I had to do formal drawings that related to the idea, the color, the kind of materials, the stone, and design meeting, and we would talk about the drawings. And they, being my client, they knew that, okay, this is what I'm expecting. And then I would deliver that image to them in three-dimensional. But when I find now that since I'm much more a solo person and not doing those big commissions, but I find myself when I'm picking up things and I'm walking with them and looking at them, I have a tendency to conceptually begin to evolve them into a piece of adornment. Oh, I can do this, then I'll take that wire and go over here. Wow, that broken piece could go into here. So I find that I'm very fortunate that that excitement begins very, very early on, before I even get back to the work table.
It sounds like that when you're not on a commission, when you're allowed to just sort of let things happen, that the story that the objects are telling you is a little more organic. You get to listen to them a little more. Does that make sense?
Spot on, yes. So, and I will have to acknowledge I'm proud to be an academic person. I'm proud to be a teacher and be a part of an educational handing down information and techniques and a history of personal adornment and jewelry. But I also have the richness of being able to sit at my workbench and be open and do open field running. Let my mind be very open to ideas and pushing against and being the outlaw. It's much different than if I had to pay my overhead and the jewelry that I made every month had to pay my mortgage and my gas and oil. So I'm very fortunate, and I acknowledge the blessing of being at a university or at an educational experience that I can do what I love doing as an educator, but also love doing what I do privately on my workbench.
It sounds like it gives you a little breathing space. Having the steady paycheck and the ability to do all of those different things, but it also sounds like that kind of giving back, whether it's to your direct students or whether it's in workshops, that's part of what feeds you as well. Because everything I've read, people who've worked with you just say that you are so incredibly generous with your time and your knowledge and your insistence that they reach as high as they can go in their art.
I know that oftentimes these accolades and these comments are made, but I also realize that, you know, I do spend a lot of time mentoring. I mean, because I have, and in turn, I acknowledge having the richness of their blessings of creative thinking and problem solving. The other day, I was in Tennessee working for 2 weeks, and at the end of the time, I said to the people, they said, "Are you tired, Bob, going home?" I said, "You know what's interesting? Yes, I am tired, because in this class, every one of you, when we sit down and you ask me a question, each one of you had a different kind of problem you were trying to solve." So in a way that, you know, you made my mind so active, because professionally I didn't want to let you down. So I was stretching, putting the bar high, in challenges where I would not go because it's not it was not my work. It was your design, and you were trying to understand how to make it or how to solve a certain situation. So I find that I am so blessed that at 76 years old, my mind is running, fast and furious every day, having this richness of exchange in an educational manner, also in an intellectual discussions, also in the sense of scholarly pursuit in our field.
It sounds like it feeds you as much as you feed
Absolutely.
Your students. Yeah,
absolutely. It is a wonderful two-way tennis match and tug of war.
There's another quote that somebody said to you, one of the things that you told her, which was, when you're making, make 15 and then pick the best 8.
Yeah.
Is that something that you do yourself?
Well, I know that if I want the body of work to get stinky and get feisty and put the bar high, the one off, the one piece, and then moving to another idea. But if I'm able to have the opportunity to make 6 to 10 of the same thinking on the same kind of energy of the color and construction and making, the work does get deeper, and I begin to take more and more risk. But I do feel that if I do go deep, it just gets stronger.
When you look at the retrospective of your work that's happening right now at the Racine Art Museum, what goes through your mind?
You know, without getting emotional, it brings back many highs and lows of the journey, being in the forest and not seeing the meadow and being in the dark times of everybody's personal life, and then looking for the meadow and the sunshine. So for the Racine to give this opportunity to me, it's very humbling and very emotional that I have an opportunity to bring this collection of old and new pieces together and to share it with the going public, and the richness that there has been a document, a wonderful publication to mark that, to go along with it.
So what's captured your attention and your imagination right now? Is there a particular object that has caught your fancy?
You know, it's interesting, of the years of my making, a person who is a very important person in my life and is no longer here, by the name of Hermann Junger, was a well-known contemporary jeweler in Germany. He once said to me before his passing, Bob, there will be work that will become an icon, will become like a footprint, which it will be published time and time again, and it will become kind of a signature. And, now thinking back, there are pieces, such as the one on the cover of the publication. I mean, that piece has been published a number of times. And here it is, once again, Bruce picked it out of all the objects there to put on the cover. You know, I just brought that up because I was quite excited and also stunned to see what was chosen for that purpose. And the same way with, there's another object, it's a brooch called The Man and His Pet Bee, which is a piece that's been photographed a great deal, or the piece that is at the Victorian Albert Museum, which is the paper and gold necklace that is in their permanent collection on view all the time. So there are certain objects, and I'm very excited to see in the catalog or in the publication what images Bruce chose to focus on, because I think the menu was rich, and it was a wonderful salad for him to put the right dressing with it.
I agree. It is beautiful. And again, the way they're photographed is just beautifully laid out. And were I you, I would be very proud of it, too.
Well, thank you. Looking forward to that.
So are you going to be able to come and,
yes.
Or have you already been?
No. They're going to have a soft opening, meaning that I will not be in there. We'll fluff around it. It'll just open on the date, as you know. And then I will come in the fall to do a talk and also a hands-on with those who care to spend a day or two with me working on some idea process and problem-solving with material.
Well, I hope that I have a chance to meet you then, and maybe I can come down and we can continue our conversation.
Oh, that would be marvelous.
I'd love to do that while you're working on something, if it's not too intrusive.
All right. But also, a very special thank you to you and the interest that you have, and also for the opportunity to share this with your audience.
Bob, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you very much. I look forward to meeting you when I come.
American jeweler and metalsmith Robert Ebendorf spoke to us from his office at the East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. The retrospective exhibit of his work is on view at the Racine Art Museum through January. We'll take one last break, and then Lake Effect essayist Carrie Carlson gets a makeover. Well, kind of. We'll hear about it in a moment when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. If clothes make the man, it stands to reason that they make the woman too, maybe even more so. But where does it all end? Lake Effect essayist Carrie Carlson finds herself on a slippery slope.
After a romp through Trader Joe's with my friend Denise, she says, "Let's check out that shoe store across the street." "Sure," I say. "I haven't bought any shoes for more than 3 years. Maybe it's time." Full disclosure, I can't afford my bunions, flat feet, and crooked toes, so my shoes go the same way as my cars. I wear them until they fall apart. I drive my cars until my mechanic says, "Carrie, it's time to look for something else." It's quiet at the shoe store. Denise and I have the full attention of the salesperson, who shows us a parade of modestly priced shoes. Denise buys 2 pair. Not wanting to leave empty-handed, I up the ante and try on the only ones that might accommodate my misshapen feet. I whine about the price of the German-made shoes, but the salesperson counters with, "Looks like you have champagne feet on a beer budget." She read my mind. While I dither over a gorgeous pair of sandals that will require a second mortgage on my home, Denise finds a purse. Then she finds an identical purse for me in a different color, but hides the price and refuses to let me see the tag. At this point, we need a timeout. Instead, we leave with 3 pair of shoes and 2 purses. When we go to brunch the next morning, we dress in jeans, our new shoes, and complete our outfits with those matching purses. This is my high-end Fancy Nancy, the best I can do. At the restaurant, 4 women call us over and say, "You two are so chic and edgy. Love the purses and the shoes." We high five. That was a first. We're hot. Now what? Do I need a pedicure? I can't reveal those gnarly toes when I wear those shishi sandals. If I get a pedicure, I'd better get a manicure. I suppose I should get my hair cut at a salon instead of cutting it myself. Well, then, I would need to buy makeup, blush, eyeshadow, mascara, and whatever else women smear on their faces to upgrade their appearance. Better yet, I'll get a facelift. And as long as I'm under the knife, I'll add a tummy tuck. I'll take my enhanced body to the mall to buy more shoes and some designer clothes to complement my new stylish look. I'll consult Harper's Bazaar and Vogue and Google Anna Wintour. She knows how to wear color. I wonder what Dennis Diderot would say. In 1769, he wrote an essay entitled "Parting with My Old Dressing Gown." He wrote a fictional account of receiving a gift, a silk scarlet dressing gown that looked out of place among the well-worn furniture in his study. He discarded his beloved tattered gown and began replacing chairs, bookshelves, rugs, everything that now appeared shabby next to the gown. He became its slave because his possessions had to reflect the quality of that elegant silk scarlet dressing gown. Does an aging hippie need a makeover to wear Fancy Nancy shoes? My limited fashion sense tells me not to wear white tennis shoes with black dress pants, But do I need a designer wardrobe to live up to my hand-stitched German-made shoes and hot pink designer purse? At brunch, I spill coffee down the front of my carefully selected outfit. Denise bites into an eggy croissant sandwich, and runny yolk squirts down the front of her white tee and drips onto her jeans. We were once chic and edgy. 20 minutes ago, we had our 15 minutes. It felt good. As for those gnarly toenails, please don't look.
Lake Effect SEO's Carrie Carlson is a freelance writer, outdoor guide in the West and overseas, and a former environmental educator. She lives in Milwaukee. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks again, as always, for tuning in. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.